I am Patrick Yost, National President of Fraternal Order Police. This is the Blue View. You know, I saw an article that featured you just recently, and also saw some coverage that you received the local media in your local area, and I was quite impressed with it. I want to thank you for recognizing that the challenges that we have in law enforcement really is dependent on a trust within our communities, and I love the fact that you have taken on this crusade of trying to bridge that gap between communities and law enforcement. Welcome. Why don't you tell our viewers a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm Jason Talapov. I'm the founder of Trust the Badge. And what Trust the Badge is, it's a nonprofit and podcast that I have to build trust between law enforcement and the community. Just a little bit about myself just before I get on about Trust the Badge. I'm a senior here in Central Florida at Trinity Preparatory School. I'm going to UF next fall, and I'll be studying political science there. But more about Trust the Badge, the way I created and started Trust the Badge was mainly for two reasons. One, because of the local distrust that I found within my local community. So how that worked was I volunteered at my local police station, the community police station. And what was interesting about it was that it was inside of a mall, a shopping mall. So through the windows at the front desk, I could just see everyone's reaction as they saw the word police. And what I really found interesting was how, one, people would just mind their own business and walk past the building. Two, they would just see the words police, be like, oh, that's cool, there's a police station in the mall, let's take a picture. And the third one that really bothered me, I'd say, was when people saw the word police and immediately turned around or sprinted past just to not be seen by law enforcement. The first time I saw that reaction, it sort of touched me. I was like, okay, that's a little weird. But the more I saw it, the more bothered I was, knowing that the people inside that building, they're there to serve and protect their communities. They have whatsoever done nothing to make sure to, they're doing nothing to fear those community members. They're only there to protect and serve. So that's when it started to bother me a little bit. And then around the same time, the defund the police movement was just viral all over every headline, every news article. Defund the police was just, it swept across the nation. And that's when I realized that law enforcement did not have a voice. It was very one-sided, and law enforcement was the one being attacked because of one police officer's actions. So that's why I started Trust the Badge, and I hope to spread this message further, and thank you for your time here. I get to do so.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It was a great explanation of kind of where we are as a society.
Right.
The distrust that builds. I'll start off by saying, look, the powers that law enforcement officers have, you know, United States is a unique criminal justice system compared to other countries in that we have some 18,000 different police agencies throughout our country. So it's decentralized. You don't have one large police force. What you have is the premise behind that is that law enforcement agencies represent the communities of which they serve. So there's a hands-on approach within local communities, and over time, look, we've certainly had our challenges in law enforcement. There's no question.
Right.
We're not like any other profession. There are about 800,000 law enforcement officers across this country, and we don't always get it right. Anytime you have a human element involved in policing and interactions, and the outcome is always somewhat unpredictable. And because of that, we do have instances where they receive a lot of notoriety, they receive a lot of publicity, a lot of reason for a lot of debate on whether or not law enforcement is getting it right. I will tell you that when it comes to law enforcement, it's our responsibility. Look, we're evolving. It's the evolution of law enforcement. It's always going to be changing because it's always representing the people within a changing community. At the same time, we went through, a horrendous event, a series of events that changed trust in law enforcement.
Right.
And so we all have a responsibility to try and pull that back together. I will tell you, I think the most frustrating, you talk about that period of time and defunding and reimagining policing. I'm not even sure what that looks like. Let me tell you what the reality of it is. The reality of it is most violent crime in this country is committed by a small percentage of people. When we were able to remove those small percentage of violent offenders and take them off the streets, and they don't continue to prey within our communities. And so the distrust of law enforcement, of trying to keep our community safe, it put us in a position where we were creating a revolving door criminal justice system, and we saw what it did with crime in major cities across this country. So we've got a lot of work to do. The very existence of us as a profession has to do with that level of trust that we're able to do. And unfortunately, during that time, 3-4 years ago, we weren't talking. We were talking at each other. A lot of finger pointing, a lot of ideas on how to fix moving forward. But I'm going to tell you what, they were all voided for a period of time, a law enforcement perspective. I can tell you the people that understand policing the most are the ones that do it every single day. And so what we saw was a lot of legislation that came down that was void of any input from law enforcement. And we see some of the disastrous results of some of the failed experiments. We're all invested in the same. We all want the same outcome. We want safe communities. And law enforcement officers want to go to work and return home to their families at the end of the day. We're all looking for that safety and that sense of security. And it was a very difficult time for us. I appreciate you giving voice, or at least trying to create a dialogue, something that was void there for a little while because we weren't talking to each other. It was a lot of talking about each other. I know you have a series of questions, because in your article you said that you would like to interview me, and so let's go ahead and see if we can unpack some of those and talk through this, and then maybe I'll have a couple for you as well.
Sure. So I just want to get started with just knowing about you in general. So how did you become president of the Fraternal Order of Police, and what events in your what was your career before that?
Well, I'll tell you that I started my career a long time ago. I did 36 years of law enforcement in an agency right outside of the city of New Orleans. And I'll be honest with you, my path that brought me to law enforcement was not a normal one. It's not something that I had a life's ambition to want to be a law enforcement officer. I worked at a industrial complex, and they had a layoff, and they were hiring. And I looked at law enforcement as a job that I would get into, and I would do it for a little while and then move on until I found the next thing I wanted. But once I got into law enforcement, I quickly, fell in love with this profession. It was at times it was a job that I couldn't imagine doing the rest of my life, and other times I couldn't imagine doing anything else. And that's kind of the love affair for people in law enforcement, of struggling back and forth with mixed emotions of the profession we have. And so what started out for me, it was a temporary, I was out of a job and looking for something, turned into a full career. And, eventually somewhere along the way, became very active in my Fraternal Order of Police in my local lodge, and served six terms as a local lodge president, and then went on to the Louisiana State Lodge, served 10 terms as 10 years as a state lodge president. And then I got elected to the national board a little 22, 23 years ago, and, held several different positions, but for the last five, I've been the national president. It's been the greatest honor that I have, in my professional career, is representing those that are brave enough to pin on a badge and stand on a line between order and chaos in their communities.
Absolutely. So far in your time in the FOP, what changes have you seen that you really support and that you help support implement?
Well, look, you just asked a question that we could fill probably hours worth of this these podcasts. There's been a huge evolution. You got to realize when I first started, we were using car mounted radios, and just in a change in technology within law enforcement and how it's ever changing, and just the evolution during that particular time. There are a number of issues. I will say this: I when I started, law enforcement looked a little different than it does today. I've been retired for quite a few years. When I became president, it's very hard to manage both of those jobs because of the demands as being national president. So I'd already had 36 years, so chose to retire. If you look at the evolution of law enforcement during that period of time, and we went from, pushing a patrol car, and most of the time our radios didn't even work, and answering calls, to where we are today, I'll tell you that law enforcement officers today are better trained, more professional than they've ever been at any time in our law enforcement careers. In my time in law enforcement. So, the evolution has changed because it necessitated it. It needed to evolve. And it certainly has. A lot of things are driven by, it's a litigious society. So, insurance companies force some of these changes. A lot of it's changes just within local jurisdictions wanting to provide the best quality service they have. Do we still have a long ways to go? Yes, we do. But I will tell you that it's better and stronger now than it's ever been before. Another area that I think that I'm quite proud of, one that that needed to be addressed. You know, law enforcement officers see the worst in humanity at times. And, you know, they can deal with some things that most people like to think don't exist. And it takes its toll on people. It affects, you know, traumatic events affect people. And law enforcement officers are not immune to that. So officer wellness is something that that we've given much more attention to, something that needed to be. You know, we lose more officers to police suicide every year than we do to felonious action. And that's something we needed to recognize, because when something's broken in the service of others, then we have a moral and fiduciary responsibility to fix it. So I'm very proud of the fact that we've embraced changing, you know, just helping officers cope with the demands of this job. So that they'd be better equipped to handle some of these, you know, just the way that it affects their lives and their relationships, and the list goes on. There's, you know, the stability right. of our profession, the professionalism of it. You know, it's you know, you're asking law enforcement to, you know, law enforcement officers are ordinary people doing a pretty extraordinary job at times, and you know, what we don't want to do is we don't want to lower standards. We want the best equipped and best educated and the best decision-making people in his positions is absolutely possible. So, you know, look at the evolution of where we are.
Absolutely.
And you know, what's the things I'm proud of? I'm proud of the fact that we're constantly elevating where we are. Do we have our moments? Yes. But show me a profession that doesn't have their moments. It's just ours tends to grab headlines.
That makes sense. And just because of how we see it today, police retention and police recruitment is almost at an all-time low, and it's been very hard to recruit these police officers, especially in places where they have defunded the police. How is the FOP helping that part out?
So let me break that down for you. I think there's a, you know, we talk about recruiting and retention. That's the buzzword now. Right. Here's the reality of it. There's not a whole lot of agencies are working at full staff, and there's a lot of factors involved with it. No doubt. Look, the economy, there's a number of things. But I'll tell you where I think that we've created a crisis, a situation, and where we're not going to get out of it soon. Here's the reality of it. Most law enforcement officers, most people that got into the professional law enforcement did not get into this profession because they saw a commercial on TV, or they saw a classified ad, or they saw something that said, yeah, I think, you know, slick ad in a magazine, and said, let me go apply for this job. The vast majority of the people who get into law enforcement have some connection to law enforcement to start with. I would estimate that that's probably better than 80%. So when you look at the fact that your best recruiters are your law enforcement officers, the ones that are on the job already looking for that next wave, who's the next wave of law enforcement? Who's going to carry this torch? Who is going to help develop the future of law enforcement? Well, we're looking for people that have those right traits. Well, here's where the problem comes in. When we had the George Floyd incident and everyone turned on law enforcement, well, law enforcement, some 800,000 law enforcement officers across this country showed up to work every day, and all of a sudden, overnight, well, I venture to say in 8 minutes and 46 seconds on a street in Minneapolis, they went from being public heroes to public enemies. So when you take that environment, you take law enforcement officers who feel like, hey, I'm coming to work every day because I want to make a difference in my community, and change that whole narrative to I feel like I'm not appreciated, and I feel like you know, what I'm doing here doesn't matter. Well, what we saw was a whole lot of people leaving law enforcement for a more stable job.
Right.
I don't blame them. You know, I'm disappointed to see people leave because it left our communities, you know, in some instances in a crisis mode. But can you blame them? You know, when you've got rogue prosecutors out there that are charging law enforcement officers but won't charge criminals, you know, you could see it's a decision that people had to make. So, I you know, the reason why I say all this is because I want to say we don't have a recruiting and retention problem. We have a retention and recruiting problem. You treat officers with respect, the same respect that you would like from them, and what you're going to find is those law enforcement officers are the ones that are going to be looking for the next wave of law enforcement to come in. They're going to go back to recruiting. But there's probably a 2-3 year period where they weren't encouraging anyone to come to this job because it was unstable. And it was unstable, quite honestly, in a lot of ways by people who were benefiting from the crisis rather than a solution. Because law enforcement all along has been willing to sit down at the table and talk and have a fact-based discussion on how we move forward. Like I said, our existence is dependent on our ability to be able to have the trust within our community. So it's something that we're invested in, and we get it. That's a cornerstone. But there are a lot of people that just did not want us to build that trust because, whether it be politically or whatever, it gave them an advantage and it gave them a soapbox to stand on, and they benefited from it.
Right. And we've seen this everywhere. Almost, there's some studies, for example, in Burlington, Vermont, when they defunded their police, what they saw was it wasn't necessarily just a cut in officers that they hoped to be. It was much more than they expected, because the officers voluntarily left their jobs. When they saw that they were cutting the police force by almost in half, the other officers were like, well, we don't want to be a part of this culture. We don't want to be a part of this community where they're simply not respected. So they left their jobs. Yeah. And then the city council, they were struggling and they were trying to find ways to get those officers back. Because within a few years, I think it was within 1 year actually, they saw like an increase in crime rapidly.
Yeah. Well, so, look, I think, look around the country. Look at the country. And look, I think we're in a different place now. Right. These last 4 years, we've shifted. The tide has turned. It doesn't mean it's turned everywhere. There are some places that are still struggling, trying to find a way to get past this. I give Washington, D.C. as an example. They lost over 1,000 officers in their agency. 1,000 officers left. They were so disgusted at the fact that they did not feel like they were supported, and they went to other agencies. They are into other professions that are more stable. You know, so it really – what happened, we know what happened in D.C. Crime went out of control. And so, you know, and I'm not saying this to be punitive to those places that felt like they needed to go down this path. The question is this. If you know it's not working, then why don't we sit down and figure out a way to make it work? And that's something that's void. There are some that are still digging their heels in and think that somehow, you know, allowing a revolving door criminal justice system in a name of social reform is helping. But in reality, what it's doing is it's victimizing the people in the very communities that they claim they're trying to protect. Because violent criminals are not going to change. Violent criminals, like I said in the beginning, most of the crime, violent crime in this country, is committed by a small percentage of people. And when we're able to take those people off of the streets and incarcerate them, what we find is we find crime rates go down, violent crime rates go down.
How has the FOP helped those police departments who suffered from these movements just a few years ago?
So you first you have to understand who the FOP is. If I could, I'd give you a little bit of a history in it. And a little over, 109 years this Wednesday we started. We started with two law enforcement officers standing on a corner in Pittsburgh, working 7 days a week, 12-hour shifts, and said, you know what, we really need to find a way to be able to bring our concerns to city administration about the working conditions we have. And it started from that. And the FOP has grown into the oldest and largest, in my opinion, the most respected in the halls of power police organization in the country with 374,000 members. But we have almost 2,400 individual lodges. And I think the reason why the FOP is the size that it is and its success that it has is because we're unique in the fact that we're not like some other organizations. We're not a top-down organization. We all have our role that we play, but in reality, in order to be a member of Fraternal Order of Police, you have to be a member of a local lodge. That local lodge represents a local agency or a local community, and as a result, it takes on the personality and the needs for that particular community. I mentioned it was 18,000 different agencies out there in the United States. They all have their own mission, kind of a little different, and because of that, it brings it down to the local level. And that's sort of who we are. You know, we have lodges that may represent 15, 20 agencies, but, you know, with their members are in it. But, you know, of our 2,400 lodges, they're working within their communities, trying to build that trust, trying to build the things that they need. Our job on a national level and a state level is to give them voice in state houses and to give them voice in Washington and talk about a broader view on how these how these issues affect everything. On a national level, we're constantly engaged with Congress and the administration and different branches of government here in order to be able to build better systems so that we can work through the issues that we have and constantly evolve with the changes in America. In a state house is the same. Every state does the same thing. They take a collection of their lodges. You're in Florida. Florida has a pretty substantial presence with the Fraternal Order of Police. And in a state legislature, all of those local lodges, although they're in their own local communities, playing a big role of what they do, building support for at the local level. The state is giving voice to the state house, and that's who we are. So, you know, it's a wide range of the support we give, and it's in many ways mirrored to that local need, that local personality of those local lodges and those state lodges, and, you know, nationally a much larger voice talking about those issues in legislation, federal grants, working through Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Labor, and trying to provide the best possible stable working environment and safest working environment we can for officers across this country.
Thank you. And in the future of the FOP, what do you hope to see that the FOP can expand on and potentially reach a high score of?
Well, you know, look, that's not an easy question to answer because we have quite a few. So I'll break them down for you. I want to continue to make sure that if you look at the, you know, law enforcement officers felt void of people speaking for them. It doesn't mean people weren't speaking. It just means that some networks wouldn't carry it. But if you look at the amount of media representation with the Fraternal Order of Police, you'll see compared to the other organizations, it's way off the chart. A lot of it has to do with our structure. It has to do with the fact that we have all of these individual lodges that are in local media markets that are talking about local issues. And because of that, the numbers are almost 7-1 of the other prominent organizations. So, I want to continue that voice. I want to continue to have meaningful dialogue. I also want to voice the frustrations of our members so that the people better understand the challenges that we have as a profession, the role that we have. I want to humanize who we are. For a long time that we were dehumanized, it's easier to pick on or talk down to or degrade something you don't know. The reality is every one of these law enforcement officers live in your communities. Their kids go to the same schools. They shop at the same stores. They go to the same church. They play rec ball. They're coaches at rec ball. They do all of these things. But it's easier to be critical of who we are when you don't know us. So I would love to, goal is to try and humanize law enforcement again. And we've taken some great steps to do that. And I mentioned officer wellness. I want to fix people before they're broken. I want to give them the tools to be resilient, knowing that the demands of this job is going to be a challenge for them. So rather than talk about how we lost someone, we should be talking about how we make someone more resilient so that they can withstand, the challenges of this job. We have a moral and fiduciary responsibility to fix the things that are broken. And we also have that same responsibility to give it the tools it needs to not be broken. And the list goes on. Providing benefits to our members, the size of our organization allows us to, pull those resources together and get some, benefits that are beneficial to our members. And it's all built around, trying to stabilize the law enforcement profession, and make our job more attractive. That working conditions, through union contracts, through collective bargaining, through, meet and confer. We have a wide range of how we do these things, working with city administrations. We're building stability into the profession. So the law enforcement officers who have chose this as a career know that it's a career that they can, when I do the job that you asked me to do and you train me to do and you sent me out there to do based on rules and policies, when I do them, that you're going to support me for doing that. The day we do that, the day that we law enforcement officers feel valued. But if I do exactly what you train me to do and you don't back me up, when it's politically advantageous to not do so, then what is it? What's that message? I think we all want to feel like in life what we're doing makes a difference and be appreciated. And when we're not appreciated, then we see the results from that mass exodus.
So for those listening to this interview, those that are law enforcement, what would you tell them to let them know that the FOP is representing them and protecting them?
Well, look, anyone who is brave enough to pin on a badge and go out in their communities and make a difference in people for the most part don't even know, and to stand that fine line between order and chaos and deal, as I mentioned, deal with people who most would like to think don't exist in society. It's our job to keep that distance between them. So my hat's off to anyone who takes the noble profession of law enforcement. We have a very important role in American society, and not just that, but in every free nation. Law enforcement has a very important role to your quality of life. And look, if you look at a lot of communities across this country, they'll wake up in the morning and they'll feed their kids and send them off to school and they'll go to work and they'll do their jobs and they come back the next day, they'll do it again. That cycle of life is often taken for granted. Not every place in this world enjoys that cycle of life. And it's a sense of security of knowing that we have rules and there's consequences for inappropriate behavior and in activity and criminal activity. All of these things play into it. We take for granted this this cycle of life. And at the same time, in many cases, law enforcement officers are criticized and dehumanized by the very people who benefit from the services they provide. So my comment, you know, my what I say to law enforcement officers across this country, good for you. Thank you for standing up for that servant heart and going out in communities across this country and doing what we do, because it's not in our DNA to let bad things happen to good people. Thank you.
Thank you. And, it just froze for a second. I just want to ask, for those in communities that have law enforcement that's not necessarily represented by their governments and their local officials, how do they trust the badge knowing that their police departments are not up to, let's say, their actual funding that they need?
So I think there are two parts of the questionnaire. So if I can kind of break it down a little bit, because sure. I think one maybe is a little bit of an explanation. The way our system is built, you know, is designed, is that those local governments do have authority over their police forces or their enforcement they have within their communities. I think that a lot of what you see, people that work in government, the challenge they have is to try and fund all of the things that have to do with government, all of the different aspects that they do. And so often when you look at law enforcement, it's probably, in most cases, public safety is probably the biggest financial burden a community has, a jurisdiction has, when it comes to balancing all of those funds. And so they often get in the weeds a little bit about saying, hey, you know, I want everything to be balanced and level, and too much is going to law enforcement. But I'll just ask that what they really need to do is you know, those agencies, those city administrators, those city council members, those members of Congress, members of, you know, in state legislatures, state houses, and a house in, you know, different sides of the houses in states. And take a look and you know, you're right. A lot of what we do, our responsibility is to provide safe communities. So a lot of what the expenses are within a community and a quality of life is directly related to that public safety, police and fire and EMS. Look at your communities and just, I'm going to ask, what would it look like if you didn't have a nice, stable community with police and fire and public safety in its optimum level? What does it do to quality of life within a community? So yes, maybe it is a little difficult to find that balance in funding, but at the same time, let's don't lose sight of what that role is and really what the quality of a community is. And at the same time, recognizing that it's not just public safety. It really is all of the different aspects of the community that gives us very healthy communities. It's a little sure. Give and take all the way around.
Sure. And I just wanted to ask about the mental health calls. So as you may know, one of the reasons why law enforcement has come into question is because of their responses to mental health calls. And as we both know, there are mixed opinions about it, and it's actually one of the reasons why defund the police became a thing was because of how law enforcement responds to mental health. Do you think that law enforcement should be trained, every law enforcement officer should be trained to respond to mental health crises, or do you think that there should be a specific community group that responds to these calls instead?
So, again, it's a very good question, and it's got it's a pretty complicated answer. So I'm going to break it down, give a little history of how we got where we are, and the simple answer to your question is we absolutely need to be trained better to deal with mental health. Here's the reality of it. Years ago, the stigma of being in a mental institution was something that was challenged by many, and said, you know what, this is not the best model. And the best model of putting people institutionalized is not the best way to provide help for them. Now, here's the thing, and I'm not going to argue that. I won't argue that at all. It's not my wheelhouse, so I really can't tell you. But it, you know, my gut tells me that, you know, I can't argue with that premise. Let me tell you where it fell short, though. What we did is we stopped having mental institutions. We have a lot of people in this country that have mental illness. You have a lot of people that have learning disabilities. You have a lot of factors. Drug abuse, all of these things are all factors that law enforcement has to deal with. But here's the reality of it. We don't have those institutions anymore. You know where the largest mental health institutions are right now in the United States?
No.
It's local jurisdictions, correctional facilities.
Oh.
Because those people were now put on a street and in many ways can't cope within society and find themselves caught in a criminal justice system. And I'll ask, if it wasn't, it wasn't healthy to put them in a mental institution. Tell me how it's healthy to put them in a correctional institution. So, you know, when it comes to mental health, I think as a nation have a lot that we can do to try and fix this problem. And it's, you know, don't put it on a step on the feet of law enforcement officers, because this problem wasn't created by law enforcement. It was created by maybe not a very good, strong follow through on what might have been, you know, well-intended, but certainly did not follow through and created a whole different crisis within itself. So I think it was important to point that out, because law enforcement found themselves dealing with something they had not dealt with before. It caused us to adapt and have to overcome that. So did we do it as fast as maybe we should? Well, again, all of it has to come with funding and the ability to be able to train and deal with these. And again, as I mentioned before, I'm going to come back and say it again. Anytime you have a human element, the outcome is always, especially when it's a non-compliance, the outcome is always going to be uncertain. So you put law enforcement in a role that they are dealing with something where maybe there might be a better path for it. So, yes, law enforcement needs to be better trained. We need to be better trained in de-escalation. We need to be better trained in dealing with mental health. There's no question. So the last part that I think that you were asking was whether this is a role for law enforcement, whether it's a role for someone else, is correct? Okay, yes. You know, there's a model there. It's called dual response, and the response worked real good. And agencies that can afford this, now what they'll do is they'll send mental health experts along with law enforcement officers, and they'll deal with these high volume calls where they're necessary, where they can work through those issues. Here's where the challenge comes is you're dealing with people that are unstable. Let me just be honest with you and just tell you that a large percentage of law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty are responding to calls from family members about a family member who's mentally disturbed, and calling, pleading for the police to come help them and find themselves as victims as well. So, you know, it puts us in a very difficult situation too. Now, I want to just point out to you that when you're dealing with people that are who see no future, no hope, that outcome is disastrous for law enforcement officers at a very high rate. And I'm going to tell you, it would be the same for social responses as well. And we just need to recognize that we've created some instability because of the way that we handle the whole mental health thing. And you add to that drug abuse and, you know, a number of other factors, and you can see where it's just expanding. We need to do more. But I think the perception is taking money away from law enforcement and giving it to someplace else, because you need to find another way to be able to deal with mental health is a disservice, because what you're doing is you're undermining law enforcement, fixing another problem. What you need to do is recognize that we created a problem and we need to put resources in to fix the problem. Taking it from one and destabilizing it in order to be able to create another service is really not the best model. If you really want to address it, you need to recognize that there's a proper way to do it. And a proper way is not to diminish one as a result of the other, because we're seeing what's happening with that across the country.
Okay, thank you so much. I also don't want to take up too much of your time, because I know we have 30 minutes on our hands, correct?
Okay, we'll take what you need.
Sure. Also, I don't know if you've seen this story recently, but on May 3rd here in Florida, where I live, there was a police officer who was at the wrong apartment door, and the person who opened the door was an airman of the U.S. Air Force. What happened was, according to the body cam footage, the sheriff deputy knocked on the door twice, announced who he was, sheriff's department. But when the door was opened, Roger Fortson, the airman who opened the door, had a firearm in his hands. It was not pointing at the officer, but it was just in his hands as he opened the door, in his right hand, pointing towards the ground. But as soon as the officer saw the gun, with no verbal action, he shot him six times in the chest. So instead of telling him to put the gun down or to just disarm himself, he immediately killed him. In situations like these, as we both know, this is where distrust comes into play. This is why communities become so distrustful of their law enforcement. And it's because, again, of that one law enforcement officer that is going to be held accountable. And again, it's going to be politicized, as I've seen the Democratic Party of that local community is trying to have implicit bias training or whatnot. But in situations like these, how do we tell the community that the law enforcement still can be trusted?
So I'm just going to be honest. I do not know the this incident. So to try and comment specifically about it, it just would not be fair, because I couldn't do any justice with it without knowing all the details. But I will say what you've just identified to me is it shows the complexities of law enforcement. There's a human element involved. It's not always perfect. I would imagine that the officer probably was knocking on a door because they were responding to some particular scenario. Whether it was the right door or not, their expectation was, error or not, their mindset is I'm dealing with a certain situation. And I don't want to desensitize this, nor do I want to make it sound like it's okay, because I'm not saying that. I think that's where training comes, and we need to do more of it. But I will tell you this, that not far from where I'm seated right now is a memorial wall. And there are 24,000 names on that memorial wall. And of that, there are a whole lot of officers who found themselves in situations where they needed to react in a second. And so it would be wrong for me to take somebody's mindset that they were at that given time, regardless of whether they made an error being there. They obviously sent there for a call. If this call was something that put them at a heightened awareness, seeing that weapon, what they did in that time, I let the facts play themselves out with it, but I think it shows the complexity of just how difficult policing is. It's not as easy as it sounds. I just go patrol streets and wave to people. It's not. We're dealing and responding to real situations in communities that are not always clean and well-defined. Officers have to make a split-second decision. And I mentioned those 24,000 as officers that needed to make split-second decisions in a split second. In many cases, it cost them their lives. So it's a very dangerous job, and law enforcement officers need to have a sense of heightened awareness. And like I said, unfortunately, we don't always get it right. And sometimes we do, and sometimes we need to recognize that when we do have a use of force, it's never, I can tell you in all of my time, I've never, regardless of what the circumstances are, it could be 100% justified in use of force, it's never going to look pretty.
I know we are just out of time. Do you have any final thoughts for the audience?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions for you, if it's okay with you. Since we're doing this dual podcast here, I think this is a very good dialogue, and I think if we have good discussion, asking questions and hearing things from different perspectives, and maybe we can tear down some of the walls that exist between law enforcement and in the communities we serve, and in your case with the younger generation who's hearing different things and wanting to know why we do the things that we are. So tell me, you explained your path of why you did this, but what would you say to someone out there that says, I really like what I'm hearing here, and how can I be part of carrying this message just like you are? What advice would you have for them?
Well, I would tell them to just do the simple things. I mean, when you see a law enforcement officer, give them a thank you. Thank them for their service, because what they're doing is they're putting their lives on the line every single day to make sure that their communities are safe. And when we have those same law enforcement officers not being respected by, for example, some communities that we've seen in the past few years, then they quit their jobs, and now your communities are less safe. So simply, just the simple things, just let them know. And if there's a community event that involves law enforcement relationship building activities, attend that. Go talk to a police officer, see what they have to say. I mean, they're really just humans. They're just like us. They're not superhumans at all. And they're just humans to go talk to. So I would just say have as much communication as you can with them. Get to know them. They're not much different than you are, other than the fact that their job is to protect you. So go have a conversation, so I would say.
That's a great advice. Let's leave it at that. There's not a problem that we can't fix if we commit ourselves to do it. We just got to commit ourselves to be able to have a fact-based discussion and listen to what each other have to say.
Right.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity to spend some time with you and talk about a very important issue. And I appreciate what you're doing to help call attention to law enforcement and the need for us to rally behind and work through any differences we may have and create better and stronger communities.
Absolutely. And thank you for your time as well. I mean, this is an opportunity for Trust the Badge and, of course, your message as well to really be spread to a wider audience that it's a message that's very necessary in today's society, as we've seen. So thank you very much.
So if someone wants to follow your podcast, Where do they need to go? How did it, you know, tell us a little bit about how to follow you.
Sure. So Trust the Badge is on any platform such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, you name it. It's everywhere. It's on there. If you want to follow the main Trust the Badge website, it's trustthebadge.com. You can find it on Google, any browser, and social media. Trust the Badge is mainly on Instagram, so at Trust the Badge. So thank you very much, and I really appreciate this opportunity to really spread the message of Trust the Badge.
And to our viewers and listeners back home, thank you for tuning in to the Blue View Podcast. Well, we talk about the issues that are so vitally important to the men and women who suit up and show up every single day across this country and make a difference in the lives we serve.
Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. To get the latest from the National FOP, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at GLFOP and on Instagram at FOP National. Thanks again. We'll see you next time.